left behind. A State Department official confirmed today the majority of Afghans who worked for the U.S. during the Afghanistan war were not rescued in time. And the Taliban could now be using American technology to hunt them down. Also tonight, thousands of homes and businesses back on the grid in New Orleans, which leaves almost a million spending one more night in the dark and the heat. A small ray of progress 3.5 days after Cat 4 Hurricane Ida. Welcome to Banfield. It is September 1st, 2021, the day after the longest war in U.S. history officially ended. And yet tonight, America's full diplomatic and military attention is still squarely focused on the country it just evacuated, Afghanistan. That's because of who and what the U.S. left behind when it loaded up those last few aircraft like this one. These images were just released by the Pentagon. Night vision of some of the last U.S. troops boarding an aircraft and ready to leave. Hundreds and hundreds of military members all standing shoulder to shoulder inside that aircraft. And in fact, when you look at it, it's far more crowded than any of the refugee flights we've seen. You can see them on the tarmac in the dark, all loading in. And just take a look at that image. That is a lasting image. As they make that treacherous journey into the night sky, they fly away from the airport and country that is now controlled by the Taliban. Still in that Taliban-controlled country when the very last U.S. service member boarded the plane. Between 100 and 200 U.S. citizens. Yes, they're still there as that man leaves. Today, the Biden administration would not, or maybe could not, say if any of those Americans have been able to escape Afghanistan since that final plane left Kabul on August the 30th. Tens of thousands of Afghans who worked with the U.S. and its allies during the 20-year conflict are still struggling to get out. Courageous individuals. Here is how the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, described them today.
Some of these courageous Afghans fought alongside us. And they and their families have more than earned their places in the land of the free and the home of the brave. And welcoming these Afghans isn't just about what they've done. It's about who we are.
So that is the big question for today. Who are we? Because yes, while America did evacuate a record number of our Afghan allies before the August 31st deadline, 124,334 to be exact, there are still those thousands and thousands and thousands left to the mercy of the Taliban. A Taliban that now has access, by the way, to millions of dollars worth of our American military equipment and U.S. biometric equipment that was used to capture retina scans, fingerprints, and biographical information of every Afghan who ever helped us. That is a nightmare scenario for those brave Afghans who were left on the ground and their friends and family back home. One of those people desperate for information is Penn Farthing, a former Royal Marine who ran an animal shelter in Kabul. When coalition forces began planning the withdrawal from Afghanistan, he was faced with the challenge of getting his 200 animals and all of his staff members and their families out of the country. He was able to save the animals, but he was not allowed to take those staff members with him, those Afghans. He says his animals rode in the cargo hold where no humans can travel. He was the only passenger on the plane. He repeatedly says he offered those other seats to other evacuees, but he says the officials rebuffed the offer, and he joins me now. Penn, I'm glad to see that you're safe. From our last interview, I was so worried about you and your staff and your animals. Tell me a little bit about the staff left behind. Where are you in the efforts to get them out?
Well, we're still working on that. We're working on a plan now. Sadly, all the borders have closed, and obviously, as you know, Kabul Airport has ceased to exist. The staff are there in Kabul still. They're terrified, absolutely terrified of what the future holds for them. we're still reeling from that day when, you know, we were turned away from the airport at gunpoint. That moment's going to live with me forever. I'm just hoping that our plans that we're putting in place now will come together and we will be able to get them out into safety.
Penn, I read that five of the cats that you took died on the journey. I read that one of the dogs that you had was stabbed and you think it was at a Taliban checkpoint. I also read that you were able to actually negotiate your own passage with the Taliban to get into the airport with that cargo. Do you think there's any hope for you to continue some of those negotiations to get those people out, or is that an entirely different issue?
Yeah, when I was actually at the airport, my staff were with me. So I was negotiating for both the staff and the animals. And that's at the point when the Taliban at gunpoint said, no, the staff are not coming. You can take your dogs and cats. We don't care about them. You can take yourself. You're a foreigner. Just get out of our country. But these people are Afghans. They're not leaving. And even though they had the obviously correct paperwork for the UK side of things, the Taliban wouldn't let them go past. So I don't believe we're going to be able to negotiate, you know, anything further with the Taliban unless obviously America and the British governments actually step in, you know, and negotiate. For, as you rightly said, there are thousands of other people that are still stuck in Afghanistan, and that includes obviously American passport holders. That definitely includes British passport holders. I mean, there's some British school children that are stuck there in Afghanistan still. So I think it now needs a higher level than me to be able to talk to the Taliban, that's for sure.
So what about those staff members who were with you at the airport? I cannot even imagine separating from them. Those last moments must have just been completely fraught for you.
Yeah, and I was on the road with the Taliban on my hands and knees, absolutely begging them to let the staff go forward. And they just blatantly refused. They would not let, obviously, Afghans leave to go into the airfield. They decided that enough people had left, that was it. And saying goodbye to the staff is one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. I said, I'll never, ever forget that moment. And so the team back in the UK, you know, there's been no celebration since I came back. We're just still working as hard as we did before to figure out routes and plans and how we can potentially get them to safety.
Penn, do you know, have you been in contact with your staff members? Are they safe? Are they in hiding? Do the Taliban know who they are and where they are?
I'm in touch with them daily, talking to them, and said they're just terrified, absolutely terrified. Obviously, we don't have an operation in Afghanistan anymore. You know, our animal welfare center has closed. So, you know, that's all gone. Sadly, the last 15 years of, you know, determined hard work has just all finished, you know, overnight. They're all safe for now. We're chatting to them daily.
What is the risk to them? Because we hear all sorts of degrees of danger. If anyone worked directly for the military, especially the Americans, the Indians, the Brits, they are in grave danger. If anyone worked for American contractors, they are in danger. If anyone worked for the NGOs or people like you, humanitarian groups, they are slightly in danger. But we're not really getting clarity. Do you have clarity?
At the moment, we do know the Taliban are going door to door. They are looking for people who worked for, obviously, the government. A lot of my team, sadly, you know, had gone through that biometric process, so their data is being held. We are incredibly worried about them. The Taliban, as we've seen now, you know, are in charge, and sadly, they have a large arsenal of, you know, US, British-supplied weaponry to carry out whatever they want to do in Afghanistan now. It's just a shocking, sad state of affairs, and you know, I don't have words for it. I truly don't.
I know this has been so controversial for you as well. There were some who weighed in saying the animals shouldn't go if the people can't. There were others who weighed in saying, how can you turn your back on all of that work that Penn has done and all those, you know, helpless animals? At the same time, I want to reiterate, the animals went in the cargo hold where no humans can fly. So they didn't take the place of any people. What's distressing, Penn, is to hear that you were the only passenger and could not get the Brits or the Americans to load people onto your plane. Why is that?
When I go into the airport, it was towards the very end. So the airfield apparently had already been shut to people coming in. I came in through a different gate, which was held by the Taliban, not that was being controlled by any of the British or Americans. That was due to me obviously discussing with the Taliban at each checkpoint to get permission to come through. So by the time I got in the airfield, they said that because the airfield was closed, they had enough airlift capacity for every single civilian on the airfield, and therefore they didn't need to use our aircraft to put passengers on. So I actually flew out of Kabul, sat on the aircraft on my own.
Given the intense back and forth between you and the British Foreign Office and the paperwork snafus that forced you to get to the gate only to be turned away from the gate and then come to the gate again, that in itself was extraordinarily lethal. You took gunfire on the day of the bombings, for heaven's sake. Has the British government, for lack of a better description, lent you an olive branch to say, we will help you, we will do whatever it takes to get those other staff members of yours out, whether it takes a covert mission or not? And I understand if you can't give us details.
No, it's a very simple answer, because it's no. I haven't spoken to anybody in the British government.
So no overture to help those staff members who worked for you for so long?
No, absolutely nothing. And I think, obviously, right now, they probably sat there with their head in their hands because there's so many, obviously, British interpreters, you know, people who work for the British government. As I said, actual British nationals with passports. You know, there's currently British school children still stuck in Afghanistan. So I imagine they've got their head in their hands trying to figure out how to get all of those people out as well at the same time.
Penn, do you have any other options? Have you explored any other options to rescue your staff?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are sat here now with our crisis team that we had that formed to actually help in the first place. It's, like I said, they're still going strong now. I'm actually talking to some of them on WhatsApp at the moment, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning in the UK. We're not stopping. We're exploring every avenue possible to get our staff, out of Afghanistan into safety.
Penn, we'll continue to follow your story. I hope you'll keep us updated. And I'm so sorry for everything you've gone through. My heart absolutely breaks for you. And, thank you for doing the heroic work that you've been doing for years.
Thank you. I appreciate you having us on the show. Thank you.
Penn Farthing joining us, just having escaped Afghanistan. And still to come, we're going to move from the who to the what the United States left behind when it fled Afghanistan. It is a big what as well. Millions of dollars in U.S. technology, military technology, including biometric identification devices used to capture all of the information about the Afghans who helped us, the Afghans that the Taliban are now hunting. Welcome back to Banfield. Up to 200 U.S. citizens are still stranded in Afghanistan tonight, and tens of thousands of Afghans who helped us during the 20-year conflict are also stranded. That's a frightening prospect, but even worse, the Taliban could be using United States-built equipment to hunt them down. Since 2007, U.S. forces have been collecting biometric data. That's fingerprinting, retina scans, and other identifiers of every single Afghan working with the U.S. and its ally nations. Every member of the Afghan military, every member of the Afghan police, and civilian workers, too. The same biometric toolkits were also used during their elections. So if you voted, you got scanned. There were 7,000 little handheld devices there, and now nobody knows how many of those devices were left behind. And while the United States military had time to disable the helicopters and the airplanes they left behind, those biometric devices may still be working. So might the big databases. I'm joined by Connor Powell. He is the former Fox News bureau chief in Afghanistan. He spent years in Kabul. He was embedded with U.S. and Afghan forces during major military operations in Helmand and Kandahar provinces. Connor, did you ever see those devices in operation? Did you see those scannings happening while you were embedded?
I sure did. I actually saw it happening in Kandahar several different times. I mean, the military is using it not only to scan workers who are connected to the government or to ISAF and the military, but really anytime they saw a young male who was suspicious, sometimes they were 7-8-year-old boys, they were scanning them, putting them into a database. You know, Afghanistan is a country that we often describe as being war-torn or primitive, backwards, developing, but this was actually probably the most state-of-the-art system in the world, and it was doing a lot to actually reduce corruption and fraud and a lot of the other problems that had really plagued the country. I was actually enrolled in one of these systems. The military, when I first got there in 2009, in order to get onto a U.S. base, made you give biometric data. Now, I have no idea where that information ended up, but it is concerning, and I think it highlights the fact of just how poorly planned this entire withdrawal was. You know, the key is whether or not the Taliban have access to the database. It's not clear that they do. They certainly have access to the handheld devices, which hold a little bit of information, but the database is the real key. So but it just shows you that the Biden administration didn't do much to plan.
Yeah, let me jump in there, because I want the viewers to know exactly what the circumstances are. Originally, the Americans used these devices to, you know, figure out who the dangerous people were, the car bombers and the prisoners, etc. So this was a great idea. Then it expanded to know who all the Afghans were and who was safe and who wasn't. But then there was another series of devices, and this was something called the APPS system, which was used to register all military and all police, and that's in the hands of the Afghans, and that might be the concerning data, because the Americans now are saying all that other stuff, all those civilians, all that data is actually in servers in the U.S. So it's not something the Taliban physically have their hands on. But, you know, hacking, hello, is global. And again, like you said, the Taliban are not as primitive as you think they are. Half of them may not be able to read, but the other half sure know a thing or two about the Internet. So to that end, talk to me a little bit about what happens now for these Afghans who now are going to try to escape. They're going to be out on the street, and they're going to try to go maybe to an airport or a bus station or a train station or maybe, oh, I don't know, across a border. And they could have their irises scanned and be condemned on the spot.
That's 100% a real concern. This is one of the many concerns that any Afghan who worked with the coalition, who leaned towards the Western world as opposed to lean towards the Taliban, this is one of many ways in which the Taliban can essentially track you down. You know, people have pictures of their letters that they got from working with the government on their phone. There might be English emails or text messages. There's also this database and these devices. So there are lots of ways for the Taliban to essentially hunt down anyone who they deem a threat to their government, to their new institutions. And so this is a concern that is, sort of part and parcel for every Afghan that the United States and the international community has abandoned there. They have this concern about anything that might lead the Taliban to their doorstep. And, you know, what we are already seeing right now in the Taliban are recriminations and attacks on people who worked with the Western governments, who worked with the military, and who tried to help bring peace and stability to the country.
So I'm going to just read quickly something that I saw that was a comment to MIT Technology Review, an excellent article on this actual crisis of technology in the country. And this is what the Defense Department said to that outlet. The U.S. has taken prudent actions to ensure that sensitive data does not fall in the Taliban's hands. This data is not at risk of misuse. But there are loads of Taliban sympathizers. You know, there are loads of people who may have spirited some of that information in a way. And of course, there's this issue with hacking. And to be clear, Connor, this isn't just name and address. This is detail, like 30 to 40 points of data per person, including what's your favorite fruit, what's your favorite vegetable, what's your father's name, your uncle's name, your cousin's names. I mean, it is a massive, massive identifying piece of data for these people.
That's true. And one of the things that, you know, I think we need to talk more about what's going on in Afghanistan right now is the group that has their hands on this, which is the Haqqani Network, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliated part of the Taliban. They are also deeply tied to the Pakistani ISI, which is a very sophisticated intelligence service. So if they are hackers in the region, the Taliban, through the Haqqani network with their connections to the Pakistan ISI, you know, they're going to be connected to these types of hackers who can possibly get to some of this information. And maybe this isn't the only database that is a worry or the only piece of equipment. There are other documents in that in the government, you know, buildings that could be possibly used against Afghan citizens. It's just one of many concerns. But it's a big concern because the Taliban, they are not primitive. They are not, you know, some backwards insurgency. They do have some sophistication. And more importantly, they have ties to sophisticated intelligence services like the Pakistani ISI, which has long supported them.
So now, and I only have about 30 seconds left, but it is important to just highlight what you just said. The ISI is the Pakistani Intelligence Services, and there are loads of reports that say it is the ISI helping to oversee these door-to-door searches to find these people, which means the United States ally, Pakistan, is helping the United States enemy, Taliban, to find the United States helpers, the Afghans. I mean, there is a whole global issue to this. It is very troubling.
Ashley, that's the 20-year war right there. I mean, that is, you just summed up what the fundamental problem with the entire U.S. effort in Afghanistan was, which is we were fighting an enemy in which was being supported by a so-called U.S. ally in Pakistan. And they undermine from Pakistan, from Islamabad, from the SWAT and the rural areas of Pakistan, they undermined any effort the United States and the international community made in Afghanistan. That's the fundamental problem of the failure of the war there.
And they called this identity dominance. When the Americans started it out, it was the identity dominance. I do want to say that Eagle Base, a heavily fortified CIA base in Kabul, was destroyed. This was some of the explosions heard around Kabul last week. This was a controlled explosion to get rid of data that was in that extraordinary base. But who knows if any of that data is what we're talking about right now or if it existed elsewhere. Connor Powell, thank you. Thank you for your guidance on this. It's a very important issue. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we're going to hear from a 62-year-old American citizen who is still trapped behind enemy lines. She has made eight trips to the Kabul airport and has been turned away every time. That's next. The evacuation of thousands of U.S. military, U.S. citizens, and all of those Afghans who helped us, that has split up thousands of families, all of them desperate to get out of Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. I want to bring in News Nation's Joe Khalil, who spoke to one American citizen who arrived in Afghanistan just in early August, a few weeks ago, and now she can't get out. Joe, the woman is in her 60s. She's been to the airport eight times. Why did it not work?
Ashley, this is when the U.S. military was still in Kabul, still in Afghanistan, and the directive that she was getting from the State Department, according to her family, was to show up at the airport and be at a specific area. So she went there multiple times. She had family escort her there. But what she found was hundreds, if not thousands, of people clamoring to get to the gate, to get beyond those Taliban checkpoints. I mean, we've all seen those images of people, you know, climbing over walls. So imagine a 62-year-old woman with just her American passport in her hand trying to fight through that crowd to actually get onto a plane. It just didn't work out for her. At one point, the crowd dispersed because they heard gunfire and started running, even ran her over. She said she got trampled and almost felt like she was going to die at that point. Unfortunately, she was never able to make it out, and she is now one of these stories that we've heard about of an American citizen still stuck in Kabul. Her family is incredibly worried about her, not sure when they can get her out.
Joe, I can't imagine the disappointment, but what about the anger?
Her family is frustrated. I mean, they've certainly tried everything. Her family said that they felt like this government has abandoned them, has left them behind as American citizens. And this woman said as much as well. The family actually invited us into their home, and we got a chance to talk to her over the phone from Kabul. And here's what she said when we asked her if she felt like this government had turned its back on her.
They did not help us. We went to the location where we were told to be, but when we showed up there, there was nobody. You know, I got here as a guest, and now I want to go back. This is an unexpected situation that we are faced with. Yes, I'm really worried and I'm not feeling well. There are no other options. I have to leave, but I got stranded here.
And Ashley, I'll just say that, you know, the family knew that at the beginning of August, the situation wasn't great, but they in no way imagined that a scenario where their mother would be stuck in Afghanistan, literally unable to get out, and the American military would have left the country as it did.
Oh, Joe, it's just such a tragic story. And a woman in her 60s, what is she going to do now? Please keep us updated on the family's efforts to help rescue her.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. You know, unfortunately, what Joe just told us, this kind of a story is, it's not rare. I'm going to introduce you now to a man that we're calling Mohammed. That's to protect his anonymity. He was lucky enough to get out of Afghanistan a few years ago, in fact. But he's got a brother who is an SIV, one of those applicants who helped us, who should be here. And that brother couldn't get out either. He is very much in danger. And Mohammed joins us on the phone right now. So, Mohammed, first of all, have you been in contact with your brother? And do you know if he's okay right now?
Thank you so much. Yes, not directly with him, but we have been in touch with his wife because we don't want to directly call him from a U.S. number. So in case if his numbers are being tracked or he is stopped somewhere and then people see that he get called from U.S. So we are basically in touch with his wife. I won't say like they're fine because since the Taliban took over and especially when the U.S. troops left August 31st. So they have been in a basement, I would say, with minimum, like the time to go out or even earn for his kids because he's so scared of going out because the locality he leaves, like all these times, like he tried to get to the airport, they somehow, probably he's scared that they know about him. So, I mean, he is safe, but not actually safe.
And Mohammed, I know that he went to the airport, much like the guest who Joe Khalil had interviewed. He went with his wife and two kids, and that was the day of the bombing. But he luckily was not at Abbey Gate, thank God. Do you know, there is such a concern about people who are not trustworthy, those who will side with the Taliban and maybe turn on their own neighbors and friends. Is this a worry for your brother?
Absolutely. So, like everybody else, like they even slept, I would say, there for 2 days. And finally, when we contacted them, like his kids were crying because there was no food, of course, at that situation with having like thousands of people surrounding you. The only hope that you get like to into the airport, and then finally they gave up because especially his youngest daughter was like almost to give up, and she was the one who her situation got so worse. So we had to tell him like to go back somewhere and stay safe. But like coming back to the trust, yep. So for him, he in fact has an example because one of his coworkers who was working with them in the same office now turns to be a Taliban commander. So when he followed the news and all after the Taliban takeover, he sees like one of his co-workers who worked with him in the same office for 4 years is now a Taliban commander. So that makes it more risky and scary for everybody out there because you never know who has been on the Taliban side and who has all your information and can harm you.
It's terrifying, the notion that his co-worker is now a Taliban commander. And we're showing pictures of, you know, what's happening in the streets. This is a Taliban fighter. If we could drop the banner, you can see he's whipping a man who was on his way to the airport. And you can see him, the man running through the cars, trying to avoid the whipping. But it continues, that the Taliban member just continues to chase him down and whip him right there. This is Taliban justice right there. I do want to ask one quick question, and that is, Mohammed, do you know if there's biometric data that your brother had submitted and that they may use against him to find him?
Absolutely, yes. So he, in fact, had like one biometric data with the U.S. Army because he was working with the U.S. Army. And, you know, like part of getting enrollment or employed by the U.S. Army, you had to go through polygraph test, you had to go through biometric data. So that's what it's more concerning or more risky towards him and his family. And that's the reason he's now like seeking a safe shelter in a basement, because you never know like where they stop you and ask you to just put your finger or read your eyes, and your all data is out there and you cannot even cover it with a story.
Mohammed, thank you for telling us this story, and please keep us updated as to the latest with your brother and his family and how we can help you in any way. I thank you for being brave enough to tell us this story. And before we head to break, I also want to give you, the viewers, an update on the family of my translator. We called him Jawad. 11 days ago, I told you this story. His family, we got them out, a digital Dunkirk. We got them out, but they flew to Qatar. And they are still stuck in Qatar, and they sent me this video today, which we've translated for you, so take a look.
It has been 11 days that we got stuck here in Qatar. Temperatures are really high with too many people. When we go to the information desk, they keep telling us to wait, but we don't know how long to wait, and they haven't processed us yet. We don't know how long we may remain here.
We're going to continue to keep you updated on Jawad's family. And if you wanted to give to the GoFundMe, because they'll be coming with one backpack each when they finally get out of there, it's Jawad_rescue. If you want to go and give money at the GoFundMe for that family, there'll be seven of them arriving with absolutely nothing. 11 days and counting now, stuck in Qatar. I'm going to switch gears right now, and I'm going to take you down to southeastern Louisiana, where people are still struggling with the aftermath of that monster storm, Ida. And maybe one of the visuals that will tell you how bad this was, it is a cow being rescued from a tree. Imagine the hurricane force to have this. The cow is alive, and the rescuers are just trying to cut the branches. Getting this cow out was tough, but it is nothing like getting the power back on for about a million humans in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida. We are going to take you live to Louisiana right after this break. Welcome back. The one-time Cat 4 Hurricane Ida is technically now a post-tropical cyclone. And if that still sounds menacing, it should. New York City and southern New England are in for 3 to 8 inches of rain between now and this time tomorrow. Flooding is likely, and several tornadoes have hit Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Just while I was broadcasting to you, neighborhood alert. Severe thunderstorm and flood warning right where I am in Connecticut. In New Orleans tonight, three nights after Ida came and went, the lights are back on for more than 11,000 people. And that is no small thing. But then there's this. Almost a million homes and businesses in southern Louisiana still do not have power. And that means no working gas pumps. It means no gas for utility trucks and generators and chainsaws, and the misery just continues. Waiting for gas can bring a visit from the police if you run afoul of the nightly curfew in New Orleans. And generators themselves, if you are lucky enough to have one, well, they are certainly a hazard. At least one death is now being blamed tonight on carbon monoxide poisoning from a generator, and 12 people are being treated in hospitals. President Biden is expected to visit the region on Friday, one day after the partial reopening of the New Orleans airport. And with that, I want to get some brand new reporting and valuable insight from my guests. Brian Enten is our News Nation correspondent in New Orleans, and General Russell Honoré is the retired three-star general you all know from his heroic service post-Katrina. Brian, let's talk first about the lack of air conditioning. That may seem uncomfortable, but it's a mortal threat because we got word that there is a heat index advisory that feels like temperatures going up to 107 tomorrow. What are these people doing to stay safe?
Yeah, Ashley, it felt like that today. It has been so brutally hot here. And you mentioned 11,000 more people with power, but that's such a small, small percentage. This is a city with 400,000 people. For the most part, it is a city with no electricity, in the dark tonight, very, very hot. People very, very miserable. But there are these amazing stories of survival here. And where we are, this is one of them, this house behind me. This house was destroyed during Hurricane Katrina. It was rebuilt by the man who lives here. And then it fell again during Ida on Sunday. Oh. He was right here. This is his bedroom. You see the mattress right there, Ashley? He was asleep on Sunday when the house came down. He was buried in the rubble. His neighbor told me today he was texting her while he was underneath the house. I'm alive. Call the fire department. Fire department got out here. Luckily, tonight he's going to be okay. A bad gash in his leg, but he's going to be okay. But this city has a long way to go.
I mean, that is just such a cruel reality that you're showing us, that he rebuilt after Katrina only to have what happened behind you happen again. I suppose he is lucky to have his life. Brian, really quickly, that the water treatment plants, we're told, were overwhelmed by the floodwaters. And so that means there is a shortage of water. There's a boil water advisory. But do you know of any reports where people can't even get basics like food and water?
Oh, absolutely. All over the place. There are many houses without running water. The water's been shut off. They don't have sewer and they don't have gas. Gas was such a big thing today. We spent the day going from gas station to gas station, watching people lined up for miles. They would wait 4 to 5 hours to get gas. They had containers. They had their cars. One woman actually took the gas container off of her car to go and try to fill up. And so many people walked away without gas because the tanks were empty. And they're just wondering, where are the tanker trucks? Why aren't they here? Why is the power not turning back on? It's so frustrating for the people who live here.
Yeah, they're coming from Houston, as it turns out, because that's where they have to get them from at this point. Any local refineries, etc., are all struggling under the damage and the distress. So, Brian, stand by for 1 second. Don't go anywhere. I want to bring in General Russell Honoré on this. General, the New Orleans mayor, LaToya Cantrell, was asked about, you know, post-storm evacuating New Orleans. And she has decided that's not her plan. She says that she's pivoting to remaining and sheltering in place. But you just saw what Brian Enten said, you know, look like the shelters for a lot of people. If they're not crushed, they have no running water, no sewage, no access to gas. How do you shelter in place like that?
Well, we'll see in about 24 hours, because when people can't get access to food and water, they'll go where the food and water is. And, that they'll go into survival mode. We've got a big problem throughout the region there. They did a superb job on search and rescue. They're getting an A-plus on news conferences. I've never seen such eloquent words coming out of news conferences. But they only served less than 4,000 mass meals today. Under ESF-6, under FEMA, FEMA has responsibility to provide mass feeding to the state if the state asks for it. The parish have to ask for it. That's not being done at the level it should be by this time after the storm. Each parish should have multiple mass feeding sites set up that the parish manage, resourced by FEMA. That's not happening. We should have a plan right now for evacuating people that want to evacuate and give them housing vouchers. FEMA rule under the Stafford Act, the way it is until the president approved an exception to it, is that they will not give you FEMA assistance if your house does not have electricity. It's all based on missing a roof or damage to your house. It's not based on electricity. What they failed to adjust to is that with the grid broken, it's not just a function of no electricity, it's no cell towers. It's no gas at the gas stations. It's no available food. People have consumed that 72 hours that we told them to have on hand, and everything that they had in their refrigerator, and they can't get ice. People are going to start scavenging for food in the next 24 to 36 hours. FEMA and the state has to get moving on mass feeding. They did set up some pods, points of distribution today, but not nearly enough to meet the needs of, if you count the number of people that's without electricity, this is not going to get it. And I totally disagree with the mayor that she thinks she can shelter in place the size of that town without flushing toilets, without running water, based on the idea with the temperatures we have in a COVID environment that she can do it with the assets she has. She can't do it. It's aspirational to think you can keep everybody in that town with we need to use the C-17s to come in and get people out of New Orleans and out of those affected parishes like we did in Afghanistan, not figuratively, not literally, because we can bring ride-body aircraft into New Orleans airport and start flying people out. But people need to be taken to hotels with vouchers. FEMA will not approve the vouchers. The state and FEMA has to come together that we need a post-storm evacuation. I'm not trying to do any comparison to Katrina because it was a total different operation. We had 80% of the people evacuated for Katrina. This time we may have 75% of the people that didn't evacuate. The other thing is insurance companies will not recognize hotel stays for people because it was not a mandatory evacuation. So we got to disconnect there. So here the federal government's got to come in and change a rule. You need to allow people, give them hotel vouchers, tell them where to go, what city to go to, where they can get out of there until the power come back on. But we got the sewage running and we got running water.
So when we come back after the break, the electricity is not supposed to come on for another 3 to 4 weeks. So what on earth do you do if that's the case? I'm going to pose that question in just a moment. Stay with us. We are talking to three R's of Hurricane Ida, that is relief, recovery, and rescue, with News Nation correspondent Brian Enten and General Russell Honoré. General Honoré, every time you talk, I think, why are you not in charge? If they ask you, would you return and take over?
I give my best advice I can by text, multiple times a day at both levels of government, state and federal, and I post on social media. I will do whatever I can to assist with advice, and sometimes I may be giving too much advice, but I am telling them.
And Brian Enten, with 10 seconds left, is there something that has struck you about this storm that is different from other storms you've covered?
I think what the general said earlier, that people are going into survival mode today. It felt like things changed. People realize the power is not coming back on, and they're getting nervous.
And I just want to mention that there's a couple of flash flood warnings for New York City, all of Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, historic flooding expected in Philadelphia, as well as tornado warnings and watches in this area. This is one hell of a storm. Thank you, Brian Enten. Thank you, General Russell Honoré. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you right back here tomorrow night for Banfield.